Well, let's get into the book of Esther. We're coming to the very last chapter, and you probably said the last time there when I went all the way down through verse 32, said, well, he only left three verses for the next lesson. What's he going to say on that? Well, you might be surprised what we can get out of those three verses in our study. I don't know what book we may study after this. I have thought about the book of Zechariah. I've thought about the book of Haggai. I don't know. Not going to say yet. May not do anything for a week or two. But we do want to look at the 10th chapter of the book of Esther and look at those three verses. They give a summation of all that has happened pretty much in the book before, and they show the great prosperity and all of that of Mordecai, as well as indirectly refer back perhaps to Esther the queen, though she's not mentioned here. She was last mentioned over there in chapter 9, but indirectly there because of certain statements. The greatness of Mordecai is certainly connected somehow there with his cousin, who was Esther the queen. So we're going to look at those three verses there in the 10th chapter, and then I told you after that we would briefly look at the principal characters in the book. And they're really a type of the sort of people that we still have in the world. You still have some Mordecai's, thank God, and some Esther's. But I'm sorry to say you still have some Haman's, and you still have some Xerxes. And we'll talk about that some later. But they're representative characters like to me. Let's read verse 1 of the 10th chapter. And really, we might say these three verses are the conclusion of the book, are the summation of what followed after chapter 9. And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea. Now, whenever the Bible talks about a tribute, the more modern terminology for that is taxation. He increased the taxes, or he laid new taxes upon the people. So essentially we are told there in the first verse that this powerful king laid additional taxes upon his subjects. Now remember that his kingdom went all the way from India to Ethiopia and consisted of 127 provinces, which was most of the known world of that day. But evidently it included some other places that may not generally have been thought of as being a part of his kingdom. You note how that it reads there, a tribute upon the land. That would be the 127 provinces, I would assume. But then it adds, and upon the isles of the sea. And that would refer to perhaps the Mediterranean and to territories there in and around Palestine and going, of course, to the east there in all of this. So any time that you read about taxation, you're essentially reading about some political figure that's squeezing and oppressing his people by some arbitrary power to get more of their money to go in his pockets. So what was happening here was no more than what had happened many times in history that's past, and it's no more than's going on in our modern world. It seems like that the politicians generally spend all of their time, and not so much to help the people that they're elected to serve, but they try to figure out some way to increase our taxes, to take more of our money that they might somehow put it in their pockets. You know, one of the remarkable things I notice about every time nearly that the legislature meets, that one of the first things to do is raise all of them salary. And then, of course, they have to increase taxes when they do that. So I suppose that the king here was wanting some more money and knew the only way to get it was from the people. So always remember that the king, that the government, or whatever it is, does not have any money that they do not first of all take from their subjects or their citizens. So anytime they talk about a giveaway from the government, it's all a lie because somebody has to pay the bill, and it's the citizens or it's the subjects of the kingdom. And so I don't know for sure what these isles of the sea were. I got the map down today, early this morning, and tried to see if I could figure out some of the countries. And if he did go on some of these islands when he went to Greece, which is more than likely, while they may not have been a part of the province, they were probably told to pay tribute or they'd be invaded. And so that would probably include islands like Cyprus and Aratus and the island of Tyre and probably Plate and a few other islands that would be there in the Mediterranean Sea. But now, this was not just a local tax there, a city tax in Shushan the palace. It covered all the territory of the kingdom, and it even covered some of these islands that were out there in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, was this a renewal of the taxation he took away back in chapter 2 and verse 18? Or was it a new form of taxation introduced because he had gone to war with Greece and had suffered defeat and his coffers were depleted? Therefore, he needed funds to reorganize his country like. I don't know. Anyway, if you remember back in chapter 2 and verse 18, about the time there that they were having this feast of Esther, the king loved her and was going to make her the queen and all that. In connection with that feast, it said that he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. I told you back then that that was probably some form of taxation, that the provinces were temporarily relieved of that. So whatever that release was, it evidently was reinstated here because he felt like that he needed some more money. Well, so much for King Ahasuerus. He was a great monarch in Persia, which we'll say more about him later. Now let's go down to verse 2 and see the greatness of Mordecai. Remember that Mordecai is the cousin of the queen and is a great man of God. He's a great political figure in this book. And all the acts of his power and of his might, speaking here about Ahasuerus, also called Xerxes in history, and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? Now there are two great individuals in this verse, if you'll look at it. It talks about the acts of his power and his might. That is the greatness of the king, the monarch of Persia, Xerxes. Then it speaks of the greatness of Mordecai. And that greatness was primarily owing to the advancements that were given to him by Xerxes, the king of all Persia. And what was remarkable, Mordecai was a Jew. He was from the land of Palestine originally. He's over here in a foreign country, and yet he has been exalted now to the second position in the government. You may remember that when Joseph was in Egypt, he was first of all exalted to the second position in the household of Potiphar. And then after that he was exalted in the house of Potiphar, he, of course, went to prison for some 13 years, and after that, he was brought into the kingship of the Egyptian dynasty and was made the second ruler in all the land of Egypt. And you may recall that there was another man that had a similar position, and he was Daniel the prophet, except he was made the third ruler in the kingdom. The reason being that Belshazzar, that gave him that position, was only the second ruler because Nabonidus, his father, was a king. And so there was no way that Belshazzar could have made Daniel the second ruler because that's all he was. But it's remarkable how these Jews in foreign countries would be blessed by the providence of God and be brought into a position of political power, always for the good of the Jewish people and their prosperity in those foreign countries. And it has oftentimes been so. You may not know it, but we have had many Jews in the United States government. One of our ambassadors to the United Nations was a Jew, Henry Kissinger. And there have been others that are of Jewish descent that have been high in our government here. And you may not know it, but it's still going on today. God is blessing these Jews wherever they are, seem like, in the world. Oftentimes it's true, and it was certainly true here. Now let's think about a few facts that are stated here. All the great acts of Xerxes, where are they? Except for a few fragments of history here and there that has been uncovered by the archaeologists. There's very little known about this man, Xerxes. And really, there's probably just about as much about him in this book of Esther as there is anywhere when you think about it. It's probably one of the best history books on him. Isn't it strange how that the acts of the great Xerxes are not recorded in the Scripture except as they pertain to Mordecai and Esther and the Jewish people? And had it not have been for that connection that he had with them, he would have never been mentioned in the Bible. So you see, all of these books of human greatness, they're lost and they're buried in oblivion. But what? The acts of God's people are recorded in a book that is still alive, and we're still reading and studying this book, and the book of Esther is thousands of years old, but yet it's still preserved. God has preserved His Word, but He has not preserved the record of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. So, the sacred book of Esther is still alive and still honored, unlike the records there of the kings. They're not recorded here in the Bible. We don't know what was in those records. We'll never know, probably. So I want to stress again the fact that God always mentions nations in connection with the nation of Israel. You can take all the prophecy we have about the tribulation period and the end time, and all of that is given us in connection with the nation of Israel. Whether they oppress the Jews or whether they're good to them and the like, they're mentioned in connection with Israel. And really, there's a verse back over in the book of Deuteronomy that says that the whole world's laid out according to the tribes of Israel. Let's go back and look in Deuteronomy 32 at verse 38. It's a remarkable verse. Verse 9 ought to be read too. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when He separated the sons of Adam, He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Then he goes on to say, for the Lord's portion is His people, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. So the Bible tells us that all nations are mentioned only in conjunction with the nation of Israel. And so that's why that Persia and Media are mentioned here in this book, because they had something to do with God's national people, the Israelites, or the Jews, as they were called in that time. Now let's look for a few moments at the greatness of this man, Mordecai. It says, the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him. So really, if we wanted to give a description of Mordecai, we'd take two G's. He was good, and he was great. He was both of those. He was great in the eyes of the king. He was great in the eyes of the Jewish people. He was great in the eyes of the subjects of all of these provinces. And as we've already seen in this book, his faith was openly avowed. He never denied his nationality. He always told them he was a Jew. He always let it be known that he worshipped Jehovah, that he would not bow down to any fellow like Haman that thought he was a god of some sort. He just simply would not pay any homage to him. So here was a man that used his influence for the good of his people, and no doubt as well for advancing the glory of God. In the next verse there, I like the way it reads, because it says, Mordecai the Jew. He never backed down on what nationality he was, you see. Now, somebody said, well, it said he was advanced. What does that mean? Well, verse 3 really describes it. Somebody said, well, now what that meant is that the king built him a big house and gave him a big bank account. Well, really, from what follows, that wasn't what it was at all. As a matter of fact, there's no record here that Mordecai and his family ever were given any particular a large amount of goods of any kind. It seemed that whatever power he had, he used that to promote the public good, and he used it for the good of the kingdom. So he didn't amass a great estate, and he didn't have all of these great things that many of the great political figures of the world wanted in that day and still want today. He was just a simple man that had the public good at heart throughout his entire life. And I would that God would raise us up a lot of Mordecai's to be in our government today. We certainly do need them. So he didn't seek his own wealth or anything of the kind, because look at what it says in verse 3. For Mordecai the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. So here was one politician that wasn't given to self-seeking. He wasn't always out to feather his own nest at the expense of the general public. And so I tell you, we could use a lot of people like that, couldn't we? And then I like that last statement, I would that more of our leaders would speak peace. Sometimes war is necessary in the affairs of countries. We believe the best way to deter war is through a strong defense. The Bible teaches that, and I certainly believe that as a citizen of this country. But in the main, I believe that a country ought to try to make peace. And I believe that Mordecai had the right idea when he would speak peace to the people. And we ought to be known as peacemakers rather than peace breakers. And I believe it's important that we speak peace. You know, you might have thought, well, all of these Jews here, maybe 3 million of them scattered around in this kingdom of Persia, they might have said, well, you know, I'd have kind of liked to have that old job at old Mordecai I had. I don't know why I didn't get that. Why in the world did the Lord put him there? I needed that job. I'd have liked to have had a position like that. But you know, evidently they didn't feel that way from what it says. It said, was accepted of the multitude of his brethren. I guess they were glad he had the position. And they rejoiced in his cousin, Esther, being the queen. And really, godly people don't. They don't cry out when God blesses somebody. Whenever people complain about the blessings of God upon some individual, in reality, it's coming from a spirit of envy. It's coming from a spirit of jealousy oftentimes. And that ought not to be in the heart of God's people. If God blesses somebody, he exalts him, he lifts him up, we ought to rejoice with him. And we ought to be thankful to God that he's having these blessings. And evidently that's the way that the Jewish people felt in that day. And it really was a very good way for them to feel. He was a man not only of good words, but also good deeds. He spoke the truth and he lived the truth. And what he promised, he evidently performed. And that was very good. You're going to ask the question, and every time I teach the book of Esther, they always do. They said, what happened after that? Well, I regret to say that the book itself doesn't tell us. And we might never know had there not been a few facts recorded in history. History says that Mordecai, the Jew, incidentally had another name in history that I would probably have difficulty trying to say, but he was called the Great One of the King in history. And anyway, this Mordecai died and was buried in the palace of Shushan, which was a great honor to be buried in the capital of the kingdom. And every year at the Feast of Purim, the Jews would come from all over the provinces to the grave of Mordecai, and they would rejoice in the great feast that he and Esther established, and they would sing songs, and they would rejoice, and they would be happy. It was like a national holiday. Of course, that Feast of Purim is still carried on by the Jews in our time, but they do not go to the grave of the great statesman, Mordecai. Now, Esther was buried some half a mile from a place called Tifet. And I'm not sure where it was located, but it wasn't too far from the palace, from what I can find out. And the Jews also, from all over the kingdom, would come once a year on this time of the feast, and they would visit her grave. They would rejoice, they would sing songs, but they would do one other thing at her grave. They would read the book of Esther, the book that, of course, she probably wrote and certainly bears her name still in the Bible. And as to how long that continued, I can't say, but it evidently went on for a number of years that the Jews all over Persia, they greatly rejoiced in this great man, Mordecai, their great leader, who was second in power to the king. They rejoiced in Esther, who was the queen of the great Xerxes, one of the most famous men of history in that day. Now we want to make a little character study, and then after that, make just a few general observations on the chapter. You will have to have heard the whole book to get much out of what I'm about to say, but most of you have heard the whole book. For a few moments, let's talk about Artaxerxes. That is, he was sometimes called Artaxerxes. That was his son's name, and they're confused. We'll just call him Xerxes. We usually call him that because that's what he's called in history. This man, Xerxes, or he's called here Ahasuerus, He was a typical king of that day, I'd say. He loved to go off and make war on other countries. And sometimes he got a whipping, like in the case of the Greeks. They sent him back home packing when he went over there to fight them. He did build a great bridge across the Hellespont, but a storm came and destroyed that, and he was so mad at the engineers of the bridge that he had them all beheaded. And he was a typical monarch of that day. He certainly did like women. He had a harem, and he had at least two queens that we know about. So we'd have to say that he was a man that liked women. He liked quite a few of them, evidently, like most of the kings of that day. He also was a man that liked wine. Because if you may recall, there was one time after he signed that decree, kill all the Jews, that he and old Haman sat down and had a big old drunken spree, like, right after the decree was signed. So he liked wine, and he also liked wealth. And that's seen in tonight's lesson. Because he put the taxes on the people that he might enrich the treasury there of his kingdom. So if we wanted to summarize this man Ahasuerus, we would probably say that he liked women, he liked wine, and he liked wealth. That's a pretty good description of this fellow. He was a man that seemed like didn't have much of a heart sometime. He was somewhat henpecked, it looks like, because he did give in to the women. And maybe if the boy wasn't henpecked, looking at what happened in the case of the queen, as one man said, I guess he had chicken house ways if he wasn't henpecked. So I suppose that's the case of this fellow that we're studying about. He at least was inclined to give in to his wife. He said, I'll give you half of the kingdom if you want it. And that was a pretty big promise, you know, to try to live up to if you had 127 provinces. So he was the kind of fellow that could sign a death warrant for the execution of millions of men and women and boys and girls and then all get drunk about it and laugh and have a big time. Didn't seem to bother. Typical monarch. I like what one commentator said about him. Said he was a slave in the garb of the king. He was a slave to his own lust and passions, and yet he made a pretense out of being the king of Persia. So I don't think too much of him. He reminds me of some of our modern-day politicians, because they like wine, and they like women, and they like wealth, from what I can find out. So I don't suppose the world's changed a great deal. It's pretty much today like it was then. The politicians back then were corrupt, and they still are today. There's really no difference. After all, man's been a depraved being ever since the fall of Adam. And why would we expect it to be otherwise? Then what about this man Haman? He's not even mentioned in tonight's lesson. He was a Jew hater. We got a lot of people like that today. They hate the Jews. Look at what Hitler tried to do to the Jews. Look what the Spanish Inquisitioners tried to do during the Dark Ages. And look what God did to all them, too. What happened to the Nazis in Germany? Well, they fell, and their country is now divided between the East and the West. God judged Hitler and those other Jew haters that killed so many people in the crematories there. But anyway, here was a man that was a Jew hater. He didn't like Jews. He was an Amalekite, and he was the arch enemy of the nation of Israel. And the Lord had said that they would have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And that had certainly been going on, if you'll read the Old Testament. There was still a war going on in a sense right here in the book of Esther. That war was being perpetuated. So he was a Jew hater. He was full of pride. He had great power. He at one time was second in command to the king and all of that. But anyway, because of his hatred of the Jews, because of the fact that he tried to have them all killed in a great Holocaust, he ended up being hung on his own gallows, and his 10 sons were hung also. So here was a Jew hater that came to a tragic end. It ought to be a warning to all people that hate the Jewish people that they too will come to a tragic end. And so that ought to be a warning. That's a monument to all persecutors of the Jews as I see it. Maybe I ought not to mention this, but what about Haman's wife? You ever thought about her? Now, there was a woman that had a hard yoke to carry around. She saw her husband hung on the gallows that he built. He built it for Mordecai, but he ended up getting hung on it. And then later, after, she saw her husband disposed from that high office in the government and hung, she saw her 10 sons all put to death and hung after that. Well, I don't know. I've often wondered about that woman, just how it was with her after that. I'd venture to say that a lot of her fair-weather friends didn't come back to see her after that. It was probably a time that they'd have been glad, you know, to be in her house and to be there among the friends of the right-hand man of the king. But I can imagine that after her husband was executed and her sons, they probably passed her on the street without even speaking. I don't know, there's just a little taint in history about her. It said she became a beggar. She was so reduced in poverty that she had to beg for food in her latter years. I don't know, maybe she learned how to be a godly woman in that time. Maybe the Lord spoke to her heart, and maybe somebody was saved out of that awful, corrupt family of the Amalekites. We don't know. There's no record. We have to leave her in the hands of a just God. But anyway, she was so reduced in poverty, according to history, I believe it's Josephus that tells us that, she started to beg. Then what about this man, Mordecai? And surely a whole sermon could be preached on him. He was a man of transcendent political ability. He was a humble man. He didn't seek great things for himself. He was content to be a keeper of the king's gate. And if the king wanted him to be, he was content to be the second in power to the king. Wherever he could be used, he is ready to do the job. That's a man for all seasons. We need people like that, that are willing to be hard workers in prominent jobs, or rather just be a very small job of some kind. Whatever would be that God would have us to do, if we do it and do it well, I believe that would be a credit to us. You know, sometimes this word greatness is ill bestowed. We talk about Alexander the Great. Why, the man was a drunk, a woman chaser, and a murderer. He was no great man. We talk about the great men of history. They weren't great men. They were great butchers and brutes. That's telling the truth about him. But here was a man that was really a great man, Mordecai. And he wasn't great because of all the people that he killed. He was great because the people said he was a good man. And they liked the way that he ran the government. You know, a lot of times people are sold on themselves and they usually find out nobody else is. Well, here was a man that wasn't sold on himself, but everybody else was. And I believe that's the way it ought to be with a true Christian. He was a man of peace. He did not hesitate to execute people if they had to be executed, but he would prefer peace to war. And he was a great man, great peacemaker. And when I look at him, I can only say, God, send us a lot more Mordecai's. We need them in our state government. We need them in the local government. We need them in the national government. We need them in the governments all over the world. And we should pray that God would send them. Then what about this woman, Esther? Most unusual girl. Her parents were dead. She was really an orphan. She had grown up in the home of Mordecai, that was her cousin, and he had treated her as if she were his own daughter. And so that was quite a step to come all the way up from being an orphan to being the queen in the greatest nation on the earth at that time. A foreigner at that, having that privilege, that was most remarkable. Tell you what, God was working in his providence. And God was surely working there in the case of her. Looking back on the book, she was a woman that was very beautiful. She was so beautiful until the king said she's the prettiest gal in all the empire. That's just about what he said in a manner of speaking. He said, I've looked at all these virgins from all over the provinces. Said, there's not any of them looked as good as her. Said, that's the woman that's going to be the queen in the place of Vashti. But Esther's beauty was not only external, it was also internal. Because she was a woman of prayer. She was a woman of intercession for her nation, and she was a woman that was obedient to her husband and an example in every respect throughout the book. So her beauty was not only external, but it was also internal. And we might say of her, like the wise man did there, of the ideal woman in the book of Proverbs, that many daughters have done excellent, but this woman has excelled them all. Because she was truly a great woman, a woman of courage, a woman that was brave. She took her life in her own hands and went into the presence of the king. She's a woman of courage. She's a woman that was certainly fit for the noble office of queen that she occupied. So she was a great blessing to her people, no doubt, to the end of her life, though it's not distinctly stated there. We would assume that her conduct continued from all we read in history and otherwise. Now for a few practical observations. I see little things when I read a book. I told you that the providence of God was seen on every page of this book, and I trust you've been made aware of that as we've studied it. Think about how that the same providence of God that overthrew Haman put Mordecai in the government and Esther in the queen's office. That was the providence of God on both sides. And why was it that old King Ahasuerus couldn't sleep that night? And why did he bring in the chronicles of the kingdom? And why did the man open it up to the book and read the very account there where Mordecai saved the king's life? And why was it that the king honored Mordecai the very day that Haman intended to have him hung? Now talk about the providence of God. That book's full of it. And it's written on every page. So I tell you tonight that God is still working in His providence. Don't let us ever lose sight of the fact that a personal God is working in this world. And back behind the scenes of all that transpires is God. God is working out His will and pleasure. And everything is going according to His plans. Maybe not ours. Maybe not the plans of the world, but they're going according to His plans. And in the final analysis, it will be a very well-ordered plan when we see it from heaven, a high-off place. We're too low down to see the whole realm of God's dealings now. But when we see it all, it'll look a lot like this book of Esther. It'll all come out right in the end. It'll all look good when it's over with, though it may not seem that way to us now. So really, Xerxes wasn't the king. God was the king. And he was ruling in the affairs of the Persian kingdom. The old king Ahasuerus didn't know anything about it. Nevertheless, God was ruling. And what do we generally observe about the providence of God in this book? He promotes His people. He blesses them. And He punishes those that oppose them. You better not lift up your hand against God's people. You'll get in trouble with God. You say, well, you won't get in trouble with Christians. They won't fight back. No, but you'll get in trouble with God, and that's far worse. I was thinking today about how one of the Psalms, the ninth Psalms, pretty well just summarizes how God has dealt in this whole book. And if I didn't know better, I'd almost think that David had that book in mind maybe when he wrote this. Or at least some other providence very much like it. Let's go over there to the ninth Psalm and look at the first 10 verses of that. It really gives a summation of this whole book. I will praise Thee, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will show forth all Thy marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in Thee. I will sing praise to Thy name, O Thou Most High. When mine enemies are turned back, wasn't that what happened to Haman? They shall fall and perish at Thy presence. Isn't that what happened to Haman? For Thou hast maintained my right and my cause. Thou sittest in the throne judging right. Thou hast rebuked the heathen. Thou hast destroyed the wicked. Thou hast put out their name forever and ever. O thou enemy, destructions are come to a perpetual end, and thou hast destroyed cities. Their memorial is perished with them. But the Lord shall endure forever. He hath prepared His throne for judgment. And He shall judge the world in righteousness. He shall minister judgment to the people in uprighteousness. The Lord also shall be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. Think about how He took care of those Jews when they tried to kill them. And they that know Thy name shall put their trust in Thee. For Thou, Lord, hath not forsaken them that seek Thee. And I tell you, you couldn't summarize the book of Esther any better than Psalms 9, verse 1 to 10 has done right there. And then there's something else that I see in this book, though it's somewhat in the background. It wasn't too long until the Persian Empire was conquered by the Grecian Empire. And already they were beginning to suffer defeat at the hands of the Greeks in the days of Xerxes. You know, there are a lot of kingdoms that have come and gone in the history of the world. You ever thought about that? One time the Egyptian Empire ruled the whole world, and it's no more. Now they're a little base nation. Nobody fears Egypt anymore. Maybe not even Israel very much. Think about the Romans, how they ruled the world at one time. And now, Rome is a very small little place over there. We call it Italy. Just a small country, doesn't have all that great power. Think about the kingdom of Midian, Persia. They're no more. Think about the great kingdoms of the Greeks. They're no more. My, how that the kingdoms come and how they go. But you know there's one kingdom that never totters, never falls, and never fails. That's the kingdom of God. In the book of Daniel, chapter 2, and verse 21, it talks about the Lord. It said, He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He puts kings in the throne. He takes them off, he said. But then what about his kingdom? Look down in verse 44. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So while the kingdoms of the world totter and fall, the kingdoms of God do not. And then have we not seen in this book how that James chapter 4 and verse 6 is true? That verse says, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. Think about old proud Haman. God rose up against him. God resisted that man and got him killed on his own gallows. But what did he do in the case of a humble queen and a humble man? He put them in the throne room of the kingdom. He exalted them. Jesus said, if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. And if you exalt yourself, you'll be abased or brought down. And so this book is proof of that. And so thank God that we have seen these truths here in the book of Esther. A great book of the Bible it is. And it's been a great blessing to me. Hope you may have gotten something out of it. Think a lot about Esther and think a lot about Mordecai. They were really very good people. And we need a lot of people like them in our world today. We could use a lot of them in our churches. It would be a great blessing and a great boon to the work of God. So do remember these truths that we've talked about. Well, let us stand. We'll have our closing prayer.